Chapter 7. Opportunity. Non-professionals often seem to resent their place in the social order, even when they take home more money than their professional co-workers, as when a newspaper editor's secretary, for example, is paid more than entry-level reporters. Non-professionals remain much less excited about the status quo, and if non-professionals find society less than inspiring, society is hardly agog about non-professionals. The research assistant on Wall Street, the junior copywriter on Madison Avenue, the international licensing assistant on Fashion Avenue, any of these $25,000 a year professional track beginners have more social status than does the $30,000 secretary or even the $40,000 administrative assistant. If pay rates don't account for the non-professional's greater dissatisfaction and lower social status, then what does? The culprit becomes clear when non-professionals reveal their inner thoughts. It's the nature of non-professional work itself. The typical non-professional today is a white-collar worker, not a blue-collar worker. But while the non-professional workforce may have adopted more fashionable dress, discomfort with the hierarchy remains widespread. Here is Christopher Winks, an insightful office worker, with thoughts stimulated by his first day on a new assignment. He makes clear his dissatisfaction with the very nature of the work, and by doing so hints at the appeal of professional work. Quote, "The office in which I was to be working for the next few weeks was a franchising operation that contracted out secretarial service to clients, among other things. But I only found that out a few hours after I had begun work, immediately after I walked in, introduced myself to the supervisor, and found an empty desk. I was put to work transcribing a tedious legal document dictated by a disembodied individual who sounded as if he made it a habit to speak with pebbles in his mouth. What struck me about this was that my supervisor had tacitly assumed that what counted in this job, as no doubt with hers, was the what and not the why. You had a job to do, and you did it. And since that unwritten rule obtained in every other corporation, regardless of whether the firms did management consultant, real estate speculation, or constructing nuclear power plants, what difference did it make if the purpose of it all was known? It came down to the same thing, no matter where you worked. The attitude of passive cynicism has always seemed to me to be the most pervasive feeling in offices. The uniformity of the work process has another consequence that hit home as I struggled to keep up with the unending flow of legal babble. No matter what job you do, you can learn everything there is to know about it in a matter of minutes. After that, there are only details, sometimes perverse, sometimes complicated, but always insignificant in comparison to the basic structure of the tasks performed. About an hour after I'd walked in, I felt I'd been working there for months, and I still didn't know what the company did in the first place. The office consisted of a series of cubicles with tall dividers. To speak to anyone, I had to stand up and peer over the partition. Each cubicle was unbelievably cramped. There were no windows. The ceilings were claustrophobically low, and fans spread the stale air around equitably and democratically. After a few minutes of dictaphone transcription, I gazed at the crabbed, stilted words that seemed to be flowing from my fingers, even though they had nothing to do with me, and was uncertain whether I felt contempt, amusement, or utter amazement at what I saw. As the day wore on, I felt recurrent pain in my lower back. The typed material in front of me would become blurred from time to time as my eyes had to strain more and more under the harsh glare of the fluorescent lights. My head pounded. I craved a stiff drink, or perhaps two or three. I thought I would weep for the sheer frustration and rage of having to sit down in a tiny cubbyhole and transcribe bull beep beep beep, useless, pointless bull beep beep beep, the spirit between mind and body that even easy work demands, and which I was diligently reinforcing despite my better instincts, which in any case were all locked in a little compartment of my brain lest they interfere with the pace, was breaking down. The inhumanity of wage labor can only really be experienced when its effects permeate your entire being. Close quote. When you ask non-professionals why they go to work, most don't talk about building a career, being creative, or making a meaningful contribution to society. They talk about making money. Yet people whose jobs represent little more than an exchange of time for money are only momentarily satisfied when they get their paychecks. As the preceding testimony makes clear, the problem is not the amount of compensation for the work, but lack of satisfaction from the work itself. Even at twice the salary, office worker Christopher Winks would still find it hard to keep his mind from questioning his body as his fingers type out, useless, pointless, bull, beep, beep, beep. An unsatisfying work life is much more than a 40-hour-a-week problem because of its profound effect on your morale when you're off the job. You may be pained to think of it as such, but your job is probably the biggest project of your life. It is probably the only activity in which you will ever devote the most alert of your waking hours with such disciplined regularity, day after day after day. During no other period of comparable length in your life will you make an effort of this magnitude on any project of your own. Then, for all practical purposes, your life's work is at stake, and it is understandable that your most serious struggles are to control it, not sell it at a higher price. A work life controlled by others has severe and inevitable consequences and accounts for much of the stress that individuals suffer. Powerlessness at work can mean many things, all of which are stressful. Difficulty getting assigned to work that is interesting and creative, lack of control over or even sight of the end result of your work, lack of control over how to do your work and when to do it, close supervision, lack of control over the work environment, lack of privacy, vulnerability to sexual harassment, lack of respect, and job insecurity. This unattractive package comes with a worry, although you may try not to think about it, that your blood, sweat, and tears are going into work of questionable societal value, work whose bottom line is enriching some corporation, serving the military, or bolstering some elite. People stuck with such unfulfilling work often find themselves engaging compulsively in any variety of escapes. The escapes themselves are a reliable sign of someone who lacks intrinsically satisfying work. Anxiety eating, alcohol and drug use, compulsive buying, vegetating in front of the TV, total scheduling and extreme busyness, anything to avoid the pain of reflecting on your situation. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt. Continuing on with the next section of Chapter 7, which is titled Dreams of Escape. Non-professionals want some creative control over whatever they are helping to produce, and they want to feel the interaction between that product and society. That is, they want to experience both the technical totality and the social totality of their work. They want a sense of accomplishment from their life work, not merely survival. And of course, they want jobs where they don't have to jump when the boss speaks, where they can control their schedule, and where they are not driven by boring work to live for the next weekend or vacation. Professional jobs are seen as offering such work. Professionals influence what is done and the way it is done. And they get more than money for their efforts. They get recognition as a matter of course, even for the work of their assistants. Professionals are not ignored when decisions are made at work. Their opinions are routinely solicited. And professionals are not bossed like non-professionals. They are allowed some control over how they go about doing their work. One conspicuous manifestation of workers' desire for such dignity is the fact that many white-collar and even some blue-collar non-professionals consider themselves to be professionals, even though their employers, who have the ultimate say, do not. Employment agencies understand and cynically exploit the desire of workers to get more out of their work than a paycheck. Every Sunday, through thousands of misleading or even contrived help-wanted advertisements in newspapers across the country, these job agencies compete to lure white-collar non-professional workers to register with their offices. The advertisements offer not jobs but careers, and they hold out the false promise of the kind of work and the status that is usually reserved for professionals. The agencies know that ads emphasizing career have greater appeal than those emphasizing money. For workers eager to have some creative control over their work, the prospect of a job that gives even a degradingly small taste of professional activity is a powerful lure. The actual jobs behind these advertisements usually turn out to involve little more than tedious SH-beep-beep work such as typing. Various career training institutes and academies also take advantage of the dissatisfactions of non-professionals. Although these businesses don't train people for real professional jobs any more than the job agencies place people in such jobs, their advertisements on daytime TV, buses, and matchbook covers also make heavy use of the word career as a code for professional work. These rip-off schools often aim their advertisements explicitly at those stuck in dead-end jobs, knowing that this will not significantly limit their audience. Becoming a professional has not always figured so prominently as an answer to the frustration of the worker. More typical has been the strategy touted by 19th-century writer Horatio Alger, whose rags-to-riches stories hyped the notion of the self-made man, seeking to realize the dreams made more feasible by such tales. Countless workers have saved their hard-earned wages toward the day when they would start their own businesses, become their own bosses, and make their escape from working-class life. Even today, many base their hope on this classic version of the American dream. While the dream does come true for a very few, most who try to make it lose their life savings in the attempt. Nevertheless, as in a lottery, the mere existence of success stories, few as they may be, is enough to attract keen interest in playing the generally tragic game. The odds don't matter much when it is your only perceived chance of escape. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. Okay, I'm going to the next section of Chapter 7. And this subsection is titled Opportunity to Escape. However, As the large corporations and conglomerates have grown and extended their tentacles into virtually every neighborhood, all but the very least profitable areas of economic life have been removed from the game, and ever fewer workers see real opportunity in their freedom to enter the competition and become their own bosses. This diminished sense of opportunity is an important side effect of corporate expansion. If not offset by new sources of perceived opportunity, it would soon lead to serious trouble for the corporations themselves, because the perception of opportunity is key in selling the undemocratic workplace to those at the bottom, the workers, whose cooperation the corporations need. Opportunity is held up as something that makes up for the hierarchical nature of the system of production. People would resent more strongly and oppose with greater unity a setup that they felt not only deprived them of dignity, but also denied them any opportunity to achieve it. Widespread belief in individual opportunity protects the system from potentially devastating attack. It protects a backward setup in which a minute number of people exercise control over the nation's huge amount of capital in industry, agriculture, and transportation, while vast numbers of people work that capital and get nothing more than monetary compensation for their time. Individual opportunity is a powerful component of American ideology, powerful enough to elicit support for the system from all quarters, even from many exploited and unorganized workers who are at their boss's mercy. If workers destined to be used up and discarded by employers cling nevertheless to the American way, it is not because they are ignorant of their destiny, but because they sense it. They feel that their only ray of hope for a satisfying life emanates from the opportunity the American system offers. Ironically, the more agonizing the position of such individuals in the hierarchy, and the more desperately their craving for a way out, the more emotional may be their defense of the system. Thus, through the ideology of individual opportunity, the system can keep the majority of workers in stressful and alienating jobs, and even get some enthusiastic support just by maintaining the opportunity for a few workers to escape their survival-oriented work lives. How do the corporations keep the crucial ideology of opportunity alive now that they no longer pretend that you have any real chance of entering into competition with them? Through a simple shift in the mechanism. Now your vehicle for escape is propelled not by your opportunity to compete with the corporations, but by your opportunity to compete within them. The classic strategy, of course, is to start at the bottom and work your way up on the job. However, work is increasingly organized in ways that obstruct or completely block this pathway. With the ever finer divisions of job tasks, for example, employees learn fewer skills doing their jobs, so that their work does not naturally broaden their knowledge and prepare them for advancement. Their narrow assignments typecast them and keep them playing the same specialized job roles even when they change employers. Workers who manage to overcome this problem face increasingly strict barriers that prevent them from advancing beyond non-professional jobs, unless they have the right paper credentials, which they cannot get at work. Hence, today's model strategy for positioning yourself within the employing institutions, which have no compunction about hiring people to start at the bottom and stay there, is to start or start over at the professional level. The opportunity to start your own business and be your own boss has in large part been replaced by the opportunity to become a professional and have some autonomy within somebody else's organization. We will see, though, that this coveted autonomy is restricted in the most fundamental way. Today's emphasis on finding your opportunity within the corporations keeps alive the ideology of opportunity, an ideology that serves the corporations indirectly by generating support for the hierarchical setup as a whole, as mentioned above. But the shift in the location of opportunity does something extra for the employers. It channels your efforts to escape into the direct service of the corporations. To become eligible for the better jobs within the corporation, you work to develop the skills that the corporations value. Thus, the name of the biggest game in the land of opportunity today is making yourself more valuable to the bosses. And because the employer assesses your value mainly by examining your credentials, the paper chase is on. A few generations ago, what worker would have sought college credit for work experience, an advertising point for colleges today? Who would have cared much about mail-order term papers and degrees? Today, more than ever, workers see their great opportunity for escape from unsatisfying working lives in terms of further schooling, professional training, degrees, credentials, licenses, and certificates. Local college parking lots fill up after 5 p.m. Employers eagerly pay the tuition, even though worker turnover is high, and few of the workers who do stick around will be reassigned to more productive jobs based on their evening studies. The company springs for the course fees less to upgrade its workforce than to sustain the ideology of opportunity and keep employees oriented toward individual rather than collective solutions. Wage workers are not the only ones forced to adopt new career strategies because of the large corporations' tightening grip on the economy. As C. Wright Mills notes in White Collar, his classic study of the new little man, rather than carry on his father's business, many a boy has been trained at his parents' sacrifice to help man some of the big business system that has destroyed his father's business. But there is a rub. The number of openings for professional positions is limited, and no one is guaranteed a slot. For those forced to defect from family business to big business, having to actually compete for a position as a subordinate employee adds insult to injury. For workers, the limitation on openings is simply a reminder that for them, the more the system evolves, the more it stays the same. As those who shift out of family businesses enter into competition with the children of professionals for the limited number of professional jobs, workers without either of these advantageous backgrounds find that, once again, as with their right to compete with the corporations, only relatively few workers can benefit from the opportunity to compete within them. The fact that so many workers are actively pursuing at least some long-term program of officially recognized self-improvement, almost to the point that it is a national mania, does not mean that a large number of higher-level positions are waiting for people to fill them. It simply means a large number of people are not satisfied with their positions, and a rather narrow path to better ones has been laid out. Each step along the path has been specified in detail, effectively standardizing and circumscribing workers' efforts toward advancement. The pursuit of opportunity has been rationalized and institutionalized. The stakes are high for anyone who asks, will I be able to go to school and become a professional? Riding on the answer to that simple yes or no question are the individual's education, occupation, and income, three of the four most common measures of social class. Social origin is the fourth. It is no wonder, then, that the issues of opportunity in a hierarchical society arouse as much emotion as do questions of war, capital punishment, and other life-or-death matters. Ironically, this strong reaction to issues of opportunity makes more sense than those who display it realize, because social class literally is a life-and-death issue. People experience big differences in rates of sickness and death according to the amount of education they have, the type of work they do, and the amount of money they make. These disparities between socioeconomic groups have been increasing, yet the public is only vaguely aware of them, because the mass media rarely mentions them, and because until recently academics have conducted almost no studies to document them. The sponsors of social science research evidently have not been interested in drawing attention to the lethal nature of the hierarchical social structure. However, actuaries and the insurance companies and pension plans that employ them have made it their business to know about such disparities. Earn More, Live Longer is the blunt title of an article written by a senior actuary at the U.S. Office of Personnel Management and published by the Society of Actuaries. The article, which professional schools could use as a recruiting tool, reports the results of a study that grouped over 1 million retired federal employees by their final salaries. The studies found that people who worked in the lower salary ranges, where non-professionals are most likely to be, are dying at a much faster rate than are people who worked in the upper salary ranges, where professionals would be. Consider, for example, the implications for 57-year-old males who are receiving annuities today. Those whose salaries were less than $30,000 in 1994 dollars are twice as likely to die within the next 12 months as are those who made $60,000 to $80,000. The people who have the best jobs enjoy lower death rates across a wide spectrum of diseases and other threats to life. The Metropolitan Life Insurance Company documented this by releasing mortality statistics on male employees of two large companies. Employees with low-paying positions were over 30% more likely to die during any given year than were their better-paid co-workers. Those with the better jobs were less likely to suffer fatal cancer, diabetes, cerebrovascular disease, heart disease, influenza, pneumonia, accidents, or suicide, every cause of death studied. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, professionals are more likely to be in excellent health than our workers in any other major occupational group, whether white-collar workers or blue-collar. And they are only half as likely as other employees to be in fair or poor health. They experience fewer hospitalizations and shorter hospital stays than do their non-professional co-workers, such as clerical and other administrative support employees. The professional's higher income is not the underlying factor. The CDC found that even when professionals and non-professionals have the same incomes, professionals enjoy markedly better health. Thus, the individual who fails to become a professional, but nevertheless manages to achieve a professional-level income, will be significantly less well off. The stress caused by social hierarchy is what produces the excess sickness and death studies found. People in higher social classes experience less stress and therefore live healthier and longer lives, but so do people in less hierarchical environments. Thus, the less income inequality there is within a country, state, or community, the better the health and the greater the longevity of middle-income individuals. Of all the measures of social class, level of education turns out to be superior as a predictor of physical and psychological well-being. Of all the occupational groups, professionals have the highest level of education. So it would be hard to make the stakes in professional training any higher for the individual. And I'm reading from Discipline Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. continuing with the next section titled, Ugly Scene at the Narrow Gate. As workers have had less and less choice in how to get ahead, they have focused more and more attention on the question of who gets to take the key steps to advancement. Their sensitivity to this issue of opportunity is heightened further by their own personal histories, which often contains painful compromises, and by every reminder that some people do have creative and fulfilling working lives. Touchy topics include affirmative action in university admissions, in admissions to professional school, in hiring, or in promotions. A system that promises unlimited opportunity while actually rationing it puts the worker in a sore spot, ready to strike out at anything that seems to limit the chance of escape. The disputes that have arisen within the resulting explosive climate are evidence of the gross mismatch between aspiration and the amount of opportunity available to fulfill it. Perhaps the most publicized example was a claim in 1974 that affirmative action programs discriminate against whites. In that year, Alan Bakke sued the University of California for admission to its Davis Medical School after he failed to secure one of the 100 annual openings there. At the time of the Bakke case, the UC Davis Medical School was rejecting about 2,000 applicants annually, the large majority of them white. The number has since risen above 4,000. The school had changed its admissions system so that 16 of each year's 100 students would be admitted according to criteria that took into account certain background factors. In effect, this program admitted 16 students, almost always minorities, with lower grades and test scores than were otherwise required. Even though some minorities met and were admitted by the normal criteria, that is, as part of the 84, the use of changed criteria was the only way to get the desired minority student population. Because his grades and test scores were higher than those of the 16 minorities, Bakke claimed he was more qualified to become a doctor and should be admitted. The media play given this case was intense enough to legitimize and popularize a certain notion that was new to most Americans, reverse discrimination. Within the explosive climate described above, focusing national attention on a claim of reverse discrimination could send only one message to the opportunity-starved worker. The minorities are taking your opportunity, and that is one big reason you are still where you are. Such racism takes the anger that springs from the frustration of a life of limited opportunity and aims it at other victims, the minorities, thus taking the heat off the hierarchical system that by its very nature restricts the number of openings. And so we have ludicrous situations like the one at UC Davis, where almost 2,000 rejected whites could think of 16 minorities as stealing their opportunity to become doctors. Those suckered into the racist diversion reveal themselves in various ways as they try to cover their attacks on affirmative action by emphasizing how they are so very much in favor of equal opportunity, as they make little jokes about how, for a particular job opening, it would have been an advantage to be black or female, or a black female, ha ha ha, or, as they more openly cry, reverse discrimination. The worst thing about victim blaming is not that it does nothing to increase opportunity. The worst thing about victim blaming is not that it does nothing to increase opportunity, but that it works against such an increase. The pyramid-shaped socioeconomic hierarchy and the power elite at the top of it will be secure as long as those at the lower levels blame one another for their lack of access to jobs with greater decision-making power, and as long as they fail to question the system that makes the decision-making power scarce in the first place by holding so much of it at the top. When those who have failed to break out of unchallenging jobs do not blame minorities or women for their plight, they usually blame themselves. They become targets of their own anger to the extent to which they believe that the competition in which they are failing is both proper and fair. Self-blame is another form of victim blaming, and through it the hierarchical system that limits opportunity is once again spared criticism. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. Continuing with the next section, A Strategy for Understanding. While those who blame themselves for not getting ahead focus on their failure to meet the qualifying standards for training or advancement, those who blame minorities and women focus on the fact that those groups have not been held to the standards. Neither type of victim blamer dares to question the standards themselves. Apparently, without even thinking about it, they go along with the generally accepted belief that there is a universal notion of individual merit, one that is politically neutral, and that can therefore be agreed upon, even by people who otherwise disagree in the most fundamental ways because of their conflicting interests. Upon such a notion of merit, one could base standards for qualifications that are fair and for the good of all sectors of society. Victim blamers believe such standards are possible, and they measure today's standards against a notion of merit that they think is above partisan politics. However, conflicts of interest within society, this is not a classless society after all, and conflicting visions of the way society should be lead to conflicting standards for qualification, and for professional qualification in particular. The first step in judging today's standards for professional qualification, then, must be to state a point of view. Because no one can honestly claim to judge them on behalf of universal interests. Ironically, supposedly universal definitions of merit or excellence have historically represented the interests of only a small segment of the population. Working people, minorities, and women, who together make up the large majority of the population, have had a difficult time becoming professionals, except when they have been the children of professionals, or in times of economic expansion, the children of upper strata workers. I will evaluate today's standards for professional qualification from the point of view of this underrepresented majority. We can uncover what the criteria are all about by asking what they do for us as individuals and as a society. Do the qualification criteria give members of the underrepresented majority much opportunity to become professionals? Do the qualification criteria help produce professionals who will best serve society? A detailed look at particular examples will help us answer these questions for the qualification criteria of the professions in general. Because the peculiarities of medical training bring into public view some criteria for professional qualifications that are more hidden in other fields, I will continue in this chapter the discussion of medicine that I began with the Bakke case. To be certified as a professional in any field, you must demonstrate that you are qualified. You do this mainly by completing professional school. However, you are not allowed to enter professional school unless you already possess some of the qualifications that are in the end required for certification as a professional. Exactly what portion of the professional qualifications you must have to advance varies from profession to profession. In some professions, training programs give applicants relatively good odds of being admitted, but relatively poor odds of completing the training. Others are just the opposite. Medical schools, most notably, require extremely high grades and test scores, extensive interviews, recommendations, and other documentation just for the chance to try to learn medicine. But once a student is admitted to medical school, completion is almost assured. Astoundingly, more than 96% finish. By way of comparison, fewer than half of engineering school freshmen ever get their engineering degrees. The determination that one is qualified to become a medical doctor is made more before medical school than during or upon completion. The existence of an early and clearly defined point of decision on careers in medicine works to stimulate the controversy in medical school admissions. Unlike training programs that admit a group of students and then weed out individuals at points along the way, medical schools do the selection just once, in advance, so that whether they like it or not, the results are easy for all to see. This makes any inequality in the selection of doctors more obvious to the public than would be the case in professions with training programs that make greater use of weeding out as a method of selection, where the bias is more hidden in the day-to-day training process. Because medicine demands that the student fulfill so many of its expectations in advance just for admission to training, it is a field where an examination of the training school admissions criteria should reveal a lot about the nature of the criteria for professional qualification. With this in mind, let us use the two questions just posed to evaluate today's criteria for professional qualification in medicine, both the standard criteria and the special criteria used in affirmative action programs. I'm reading from Discipline Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives by Jeff Schmidt. This is Chapter 7, Opportunity. Continuing with the next subsection titled, Benefit to Individuals. Do the qualification criteria give members of the underrepresented majority much opportunity to become professionals? The standard criteria for medical school admissions make fewer doctors of working-class, minority, and women students than the proportions of these groups in the population would dictate. The standard criteria tend to fill medical school openings with students from middle-class families, often the children of doctors. By contrast, special admissions programs increase the opportunity of the underrepresented majority. Even those working-class whites who see opportunity as a zero-sum game and who do not understand the overriding importance of fighting racism should see that this is true and not a problem. In the affirmative action program at the UC Davis Medical School, for example, few of the 16 spots set aside would otherwise have gone to working-class whites. However, nationwide, there is only one opening per year in medical school for every 17,000 Americans. So the total amount of individual opportunity at stake in medical school admissions is relatively small. But there is more at stake here than opportunity. The existence of working-class, minority, and women doctors helps counter at least the forms of classism, racism, and sexism that questions the capabilities of members of these groups. Special admissions criteria, then, benefit not only the few working-class minority and female individuals that they make into doctors, but all members of the underrepresented majority, because the special criteria help counter ideologies that put down and divide the groups that make up this majority. The standard criteria benefits neither the individuals nor the groups. Benefit to society. Do the qualification criteria help produce professionals who will best serve society? This is by far the more important of the two questions. Most people are, with good reason, more concerned about the nature of medical care available to them than about whether they themselves can go to medical school. From the point of view of the working class, for example, the kind of medical care one doctor gives workers over the course of a career is far more important than the opportunity for one worker to become a doctor. Analogous statements are true for other professions. In general, we must judge criteria for professional qualifications most of all by their effect on the way the resulting professionals will function in society. If workers want the best possible doctors, best, that is, from a working-class point of view, then charges that special admission programs lower the standards must be taken very seriously. Unfortunately, people who think of themselves as being on the political left generally do not face the question of standards squarely, and so they argue for affirmative action solely in terms of our first question, increasing opportunity for the underrepresented. Those on the political right who equate affirmative action and lowered standards know that our second question producing professionals who best serve society is indeed more important than our first, and so they have an advantage in the debate. However, when they use the term most qualified or best possible professional, they show their failure to understand that a professional is more than someone with technical knowledge. In the case of doctors, most people do recognize that it takes more than just technical skills to make the professional a good one. People routinely judge a doctor to a great extent on his attitude. This is not because people don't understand anything in medicine beyond bedside manner. Obviously, they know it doesn't really matter if the doctor is unpleasant to be with, as long as he otherwise gives the best possible treatment. The reason people pay attention to a doctor's attitude is that it indicates how much he cares, that is, how concerned he will be that his diagnosis is correct, and how meticulous he will be in treatment. People may worry, quite justifiably, that a doctor may care more about the outcome when treating a rich or influential person than when treating them. People have learned from their own experience and from the horror stories of others that they can judge a doctor even though they have not gone to medical school themselves. They know that there are many ways in which the doctor reveals how much he cares. Does he take time to listen, or does he act rushed? Does he explain what he knows, solicit and answer questions, discuss his reasoning, and present various courses of action and their advantages and disadvantages? Or does he only present his conclusions, or just a prescription? Is he authoritarian, condescending? People recognize that the quality of a doctor's professional work is a function of attitude, not just technical skill. Doctors who treat patients like machines, focusing on their malfunctioning parts in isolation from one another, patching them up, and sending them out the door and back to work, are not that different from the notorious company doctors in their attitudes and values. They function harmoniously within a system that measures human ailment and injury in terms of man-hours lost to production. Such doctors do not help workers identify and fight the social causes of their illnesses. They assign responsibility for illness narrowly to the physical agents that are involved, such as germs, without even mentioning the social causes, such as stressful working conditions, pollution, and unfair wages. The overall outlook of these doctors, as expressed through their work, has more in common with the outlook of employers than with that of workers. The competency of a doctor in his professional work, then, as seen from a working-class point of view, involves questions of attitudes, values, and outlook. In short, political questions. Politically, most doctors present textbook cases of the conservative pathology. They are arrogant towards those below them in the social hierarchy and submissive to those above. They know their place and expect you to know yours. Thus, the typical doctor works year after year with a narrow focus on patching people up, content never to take a stand against the social inequities that generate so much stress and disease. Such service work is necessary, of course. But that work, whether prescribing antibiotics or tranquilizers or operating on people's wrists to relieve carpal tunnel syndrome, is part of the status quo, not a contribution to social progress. Tilting in the conservative direction along with the doctors are the medical students, who typically show a version of the doctor's conservatism that is socially acceptable among youth. Where does this tilt come from? No apparent political test is used in selecting people to enter medical school. Rather, individuals are selected as most qualified. Nevertheless, the results, which are consistent year after year, demonstrate that the qualification system is not politically neutral, if not in its design, then certainly in its effect. The final result is doctors who are oriented toward the establishment rather than toward the underrepresented majority. So from that majority's point of view, the standard criteria now being used to determine professional qualification in medicine do not help produce doctors who will best serve society. The standard criteria do not pass the test of our second question. What about the special criteria? the norms that medical schools use to select students for the positions set aside under affirmative action programs. Do these criteria fare better on our second question? If special admissions result in doctors who are even slightly less conservative but otherwise equal, then the underrepresented majority does benefit when the standard criteria for admissions are suspended, as was done for the 16 positions at UC Davis. Because of their experiences as victims of discrimination, minorities as a group are clearly to the left of center on the American political spectrum and, on the average, are less conservative as doctors. Thus, as far as our second question is concerned, to the extent that special admission criteria play a role in producing the less conservative doctors, special criteria are indeed better than standard criteria. It is crucial to note that the underrepresented majority is not necessarily better served merely by selecting working-class minority or women students instead of middle-class white males. It is possible to do that in a way that produces doctors who are no more oriented toward the underrepresented majority than are the traditional lot. In fact, when the standard criteria do admit members of the underrepresented majority, they do so in just that way. For example, students from lower-class families who are selected for admission by the same criteria as others do not make less conservative doctors. In the words of Columbia University medical sociologist John L. Colombatos, "The socioeconomic background of physicians has little effect on their political attitudes. The reason for this is not that physicians from lower-class backgrounds have become less liberal than they were before they entered medicine, but that they were no more liberal than physicians from upper-class backgrounds to begin with." Colombatos told me that apparently there is a differential selection somewhere along the way. What all this means is that the standard criteria at their best, that is, when equal opportunity is enforced, select more carefully for political orientation than for socioeconomic background. The result is that professionals with working-class backgrounds are no more likely than others to maintain a working-class orientation in their work. Affirmative action, on the other hand, does benefit workers, minorities, and women because it admits them on a different basis through a relaxed version of the standard criteria, leading to graduates who are more likely to be oriented toward the underrepresented majority through their work. The professional's watchword seems to be extreme political caution, and indeed radicals are rare at the professional level in any field. Is the political subservience of those who are deemed most qualified just a coincidence? I maintain that there is no coincidence. Being positioned to serve the establishment is an important component of qualification, at least from the establishment's point of view. And because the establishment runs the game, the criteria for qualification embody its point of view. I hold that political discipline is a necessary requirement for one to be deemed a qualified professional. Of course, this discipline alone is not sufficient for qualification, but it is by far the most societally significant requirement in that it distinguishes the professional from the skilled non-professional. From the point of view that qualification criteria favor one or another political orientation, the affirmative action criteria used for the 16 positions at the UC Davis Medical School represent not lower standards, but politically different standards. Opponents of affirmative action would have us view the 16 positions as political and the other 84 as going according to merit. We will see that the 84 are no less political than the 16. In general, we will find that the system demands a high price, a political price, of all those it allows to work as professionals. The important issue in choosing professionals, then, is political orientation. To say this is not to advocate the selection of professionals on a political basis, but to simply recognize that the system of training and employment already does so. My goal isn't to, quote, inject politics into the process of political qualification, but to uncover and fight the bias already in operation, the bias against the underrepresented majority. To fight this bias will require an uphill battle all the way. Cultural and news media, ranging from newspapers and novels to television and movies, describe a society that selects its professionals according to merit. The only time the selection of professionals is treated as a political issue is in discussion of the allocation of scarce opportunity, usually professional school admissions. Even then, it is taken for granted that any politics end after admission, and that the ultimate certification to work as a professional is given or denied on the basis of a straightforward evaluation of the individual's technical skills. The notion that the individual's attitude, values, and orientation toward the underrepresented majority should play an important role in this evaluation, as the example of doctors might suggest, is rarely discussed in the media. When it is, the discussion is usually limited to special cases, such as the question of whether or not producing more black doctors will increase the number of doctors working in poor black neighborhoods. The notion that professional qualification is inherently political does not even enjoy a refutation. That political considerations already play a crucial role is simply kept outside the universe of debate. Recent history saw the issue of the attitudes and values of professionals break into the open most dramatically in China. During the Cultural Revolution there in the 1960s, non-professionals turned the tables on professionals by joining the ongoing red versus expert debate in large numbers. The issue was what to emphasize in evaluating professionals, their politics, or their expertise. For people in socially influential positions, university professors, for example, this was a period of intense scrutiny, and many were driven from their privileged spots, at least temporarily. To this day, the U.S. press uses an openly denunciatory tone whenever it mentions these events. By using this tone within reports that are intended to be taken as objective, the media proclaim that Americans are unanimous in their outrage over the way the intellectuals were treated in China. This outrage is certainly characteristic of American intellectuals, who with the slightest reminder still hotly denounce the treatment of their counterparts in China received at the hands of the masses. As this has been well publicized, some of the Chinese youth brigades went beyond militant but nonviolent means. However, the comfortable American intellectuals who denounce them show little understanding of the rage that fueled the violence. But even the nonviolent aspects of a cultural revolution rile up American intellectuals. They talk about the sending of professionals to do manual work on farms or in factories for 5 years as if it were a crime against nature, the work itself a living nightmare. And they ridicule the notion that professionals can learn from the peasants. American non-professionals, on the other hand, many of whom have been known to spend their entire lives doing farm or factory work, don't get so worked up about the dissing of experts in China. Perhaps they are intrigued by the idea of challenging the roles of professionals in our own society. Despite their strong feelings about it, American intellectuals generally understand the red versus expert debate. Most see it as part of an attempt by leftists to introduce politics into the work of professionals. If this seems familiar, it is because we saw the same misunderstanding before in those who argue against affirmative action by saying they want professional school admissions to remain unpolitical. We will see that the red versus expert debate arises from a recognition that the work of the professional is already political in nature. The move to discuss professional qualification in openly political terms represents a rebellion against the conservatism that pervades the professional's work. One can truly understand the red versus expert debate only by coming to understand these politics. That means identifying the particular values and attitudes that coincidentally accompany the expert's technical qualifications, and seeing how these values and attitudes make it possible for the individual to be employed as a professional. To have a complete picture, one should also understand how professionals are political in their very origins. How the requirements the system imposes for certification as a qualified professional are political in nature, and by what mechanism the favored political orientation is imposed. I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. I'm going on with the final subsection of Chapter 7, The Instrument of Selection. Anyone skeptical about a professional training system that claims to be politically neutral should examine that system most carefully at the point where it examines the would-be professional most closely. Training programs in almost every field make sure they have a well-defined point somewhere along the path to professional qualification at which they subject the candidate to intense scrutiny. The candidate usually encounters this as a very formidable and highly technical and thus seemingly neutral examination that he or she must pass to be allowed to continue. The professional qualifying examination is a hurdle that a significant fraction of candidates never pass. A professional qualifying examination is a long test that few aspiring professionals could escape. It's not an exaggeration to say it is much easier to dodge the draft during the war than it is to dodge this test and become a professional. In both cases, the stakes are high. With the exam, the candidate's entire future working life is at stake. Anyone who is not passed is either kicked out of the professional training program or barred from entering it, depending on the profession. Candidates so failed have virtually no chance for careers as professionals in their chosen fields. The large institutional employers require professional certification, and it is becoming more and more difficult to pursue a career outside the large institutions. Careers in science are particularly restricted in this way. Almost all positions for scientists are within universities, government, and large corporations. The PhD degree is increasingly required for the interesting jobs, especially in the fields most centered in research universities and government laboratories. Thus, most people hired to do basic research in biology or physics have PhDs. Whereas research employment in engineering or computer science is less exclusionary. Would-be geologists, economists, chemists, historians, mathematicians, psychologists, biologists, political scientists, physicists, and so on, that is, students in fields where the advanced degree plays the role of a professional license, must take the professional qualifying examination after they have been in graduate school 1 to 3 years, depending on the field and the training institution. Graduate students know the test by various names: the qualifier, qualifying examination, comps, comprehensive examination, orals, oral examination, or prelims, preliminary examination, to mention a few. The ordeal typically consists of multiple written tests administered over a number of days, followed by an oral test. In other fields, as explained earlier, one must formally demonstrate some of the final set of professional qualifications just to be permitted to enter the professional training program. Thus, even though he or she is probably a college graduate, the aspiring doctor, lawyer, dentist, optometrist, veterinarian, or corporate manager, for example, agonizes over taking the MCAT, New Medical College Admission Test, the LSAT, Law School Admission Test, the DAT, Dental Admission Test, the OCAT, Optometry College Admission Test, the VAT, Veterinary Aptitude Test, or GMAT, Graduate Management Admissions Test. In other fields, the GRE, Graduate Record Examination, plays a similar role. Whether the examinations are given after a few years of graduate school or before professional training begins, they are a crucial part of the mechanism that opens or closes the gate to a career as a professional. I consider all of them to be professional qualifying examinations. Professional qualifying examinations should not be confused with licensing examinations, which are taken upon completion of professional training. This latter test plays a much smaller role in deciding who will be a professional and who will not. Few students emerge from professional training only to find themselves barred from practicing their profession due to failure on a licensing test. Even the student who has low MCAT scores, for example, but qualifies for admission to medical school anyway because of family influence or donations, is almost assuredly going to get through medical school and pass a licensing examination, the national medical boards, and become a doctor. The hard part is getting in to medical school. Investigations in the 1980s found quite a few people skipping medical school altogether by buying foreign medical school degrees and using them to go directly into hospital training programs in the United States. Two such, quote, graduates were described in Chapter 3. Even these people, from what they learn in the clinical training, pass the licensing exams and get permits to work as doctors. The significance of the licensing test as a gatekeeper varies from field to field, though it is never as significant as the qualifying examination. The licensing test is probably most significant in law, the fabled bar exam, or architecture, and least significant in the very large number of fields where the qualifying examination is given during graduate school. In fact, in these latter fields, the examination given to award the license, the advanced degree, is rarely more than a ritual. The defense of dissertation, as it is called, is a ceremonial examination that almost no one fails. The crucial juncture is qualification, not licensing. Qualifying examinations themselves are very revealing documents. Because of their major role in the very serious business of selection, qualifying tests must contain information on the central goal of all the study that leads up to them. In fact, those who set the goals often do so through qualifying examinations. Although these exams come immediately after many years of schooling, their purpose is not to document how much was learned. Rather, they are administered in order to measure the skills that are considered important in the professional. The difference is more than a matter of labels or interpretation. While an achievement test and a selection exam may look the same, they have opposite power relationships to the curriculum. The former, like a glorified final exam, is defined by the curriculum. The latter, like an admissions examination, caters to the needs of the institution for which it selects, and ends up defining the curriculum that leads up to it. Through this backwash effect, qualifying examinations have more influence over the curriculum than do the teachers themselves. By simply analyzing these exams, one can learn a lot about the goals of the years of training that precedes them. Those who write qualifying examinations have tremendous influence over the curriculum. If they impose a ridiculous examination, an equally ridiculous curriculum will appear immediately to prepare students for it. One striking example of this is well known to people in the many developing countries with British or French-style educational systems. Even after national independence, admission to and awarding of degrees from local secondary schools and local and foreign universities were governed by examinations with questions not even pretending to reflect local concerns. Thus, in the British colonies and former British colonies of Africa, for example, students could be found studying the geography of the English lowlands, English literature, and European history. Some advanced students had to study such topics as the social and economic history of Tudor England. African graduates had to know about Charles Dickens, the succession of ruling monarchs, and the Battle of Waterloo. They studied all of this instead of learning about African ecology, culture, language, and history in order to pass the all-important examination. The schools served the interests of business owners in the developed world by helping to prepare a class of locals with whom the colonists could comfortably do business. In recent years, alternative topics have replaced some of the most obviously elitist sections of these selection examinations. However, examinations still reign supreme, dictating the curricula in primary schools, secondary schools, and colleges in much of the developing world. Progressive teachers in these countries have had little power as individuals to reform the curriculum, even in their own classrooms, because to do so would leave their students less well prepared for the all-important measure. Such teachers must content themselves with stealing a few minutes here and there to teach what they think is important. The World Bank, from its headquarters in Washington, wields great power in the developing world's educational systems. With education projects underway in 87 countries, the bank is the world's largest single source of education policy advice and external funds for education. One thing the bank wants to do is to take advantage of the influence of examinations to support curricula of its own liking. It apparently wants developing countries to select students for secondary and higher education, and therefore for the highest positions in their countries, on the basis of the students' ability to answer questions that look a lot like those that appear on American aptitude tests, such as the SAT. I will not analyze why the bank wants to staff underdeveloped countries with such people, except to note that the tests favor technocrats over visionaries. That is, people who tend to innovate safely within assigned systems, over people who tend to question assigned systems. Interestingly, the bank's education division claims that in the developing countries, unlike in the industrialized countries, such tests do not favor the children of the wealthy. In any case, the bank knows that you can control the school curriculum of an entire nation simply by controlling the crucial qualifying examinations. According to a report published by the World Bank on an experience in Kenya, quote, "In the schools, examinations are never neglected. for the last 2 years leading up to any selection examination. The effective curriculum of the class is defined not by the official syllabus or the official textbooks, nor by what the teachers were taught during their last in-service course, but by the content of the most recent selection examination papers. The topics which teachers choose to teach and the methods by which they teach them are determined more by the nature of the terminating examination than by the specifications of the formal curriculum. The aim has been to harness the backwash effects of the examination to constructive purposes, so that the aims of the curriculum developers are buttressed and not sabotaged. Close quote. So too, in professional training programs, the qualifying examination is the cold bottom line. Analyzing qualifying examinations is not easy. But by looking directly at the bottom line, you can cut through the myths and popular images that surround and mystify a profession, and in this way get the least distorted picture of what the years of study are all about.